Hey, it's Luke Black, proud owner of The Marketplace. Since 1980, we've been your neighborhood sandwich shop. We're open Monday through Saturday for breakfast and lunch. And now, open for dinner, Monday through Thursday, 4 to 8. If you're craving a fresh sandwich, salad, soup, or a hot cup of local roasted coffee, we've got it all made fresh daily. The Marketplace can cater your next event, from small office lunches to full wedding parties. You can rent our space for private gatherings after hours. You can find The Marketplace at 246 Olmsted Boulevard in Pinehurst. It's not just a sandwich, it's an experience.
This is Taking Aim, a weekly show hosted by David Hensley and Stephen Woodward. Join us for open season on hypocrisy, deception, woke culture, and uniparty cronies. We'll review the stories you might have missed and prepare you for what's to come in the week ahead. Taking Aim starts right now.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to your favorite Saturday morning show, heard exclusively here on WEEB. This is Taking Aim, and I am Steve Woodward. Welcome back. We will begin, as we always do, by acknowledging our beloved sponsor, the Marketplace Restaurant and Catering. Since 1980, your go-to and my go-to for fabulous breakfast and lunch options, as well as catering services for the most intimate office gathering or the wedding of the century. The Marketplace Restaurant and Catering. My guest this morning is Lou Bologna. Good morning, Lou.
Good morning.
Lou is the golf outing chairman of the Moore County Republican Men's Club, which is about to tee up its 30th annual John Reburn Memorial Golf Tournament and fundraiser coming your way this June the 8th at the fabulous Pine Wild Country Club. They're off of Linden Road and also off of Highway 211 outside of Pinehurst. The golf event on June 8th will take place on the beautiful Magnolia Golf Course, which is held in such high esteem by the United States Golf Association that it is the venue for its annual U.S. Open regional qualifying. So you will want to partake in that event. And how do you do that, Lou? Tell us.
Oh, this is a very simple thing to do. You need to go to the Moore County Men's website, which is, what do you have there, Steve?
It is MC for Moore County, RMC for Republican Men's Club, .club, MCRMC.club, and right there front and center on the homepage, you will see a link to the golf outing page, and there you will learn all the different ways that you can support this noble annual fundraiser, which is major in that it is a principal fundraiser for not only the men's club, but for the broader Moore County Republican Party and all the candidates that are supported through these organizations. We are in a midterm election cycle, of course, as everybody knows. So, Lou, let's say that let's start as a non-golfer. I don't play golf, but I want to support this venture. What can I do?
Oh, you can do a lot. And by the way, Steve, one of the things we didn't mention was one of the things we're doing is we know we have the first tee. And we're very, very pleased here in the Sandhills to have the first tee of the Sandhills, which is actually building a $3 million facility right now. And they're funding that or collecting funds to do that. And that is also part of this event because obviously a portion of our proceeds will be going to them, which I think is quite exciting. And the other thing we do besides is there will be us recognizing over 32 first responders. And those will all have the day for free. And that their golf, as the cost of the golf, is all absorbed by Pine Wild, which we thoroughly thank for doing that. Now, how can you participate? If you're not a golfer, you can do a lot. When you go on the website, for example, you can start bidding at our silent auction items. And those silent auction items are quite good. In fact, some of those things you may have a real interest for. For example, as a non-golfer, you can be bidding on a wonderful, that was already sold, Steve. I'm sorry.
Well, that's good news.
That is good news. That was a barista premium cocktails on-demand maker. But the other thing we have is a custom-built solid wood adjustable desk by Mindy and Kun, K-U-H-N-S, who were kind enough to donate it, worth over $2,200, and bidding on that starts at $250. You also have a custom bourbon smoker. This is was contributed by Villaggio, and that's a $345 value with a minimum bid starting at $50. Now, here's something that's really quite exciting. You actually can bid, this will also be at the live auction, on having a day at the Capitol and lunch with your Representative Neil Jackson and your Senator Tom McGinnis.
That would be your state capitol in Raleigh.
That is correct.
Yeah.
And they're going to take you through the workings of the Capitol that day. I think that's quite an exciting event.
It is, if you pick the right day, you know.
Well, they'll make sure it's the right day.
Yeah,
how's
exactly,
that?
Exactly. Okay. You can see what some of the Democrats that they have to deal with are like. There's one woman who often has pink hair.
Pink hair.
Uh-huh, yeah. It's true.
Well, that's fitting. Anyway.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
Unbelievable.
But we digress.
We do. Now, what we're trying to do on that, just so you know, the bidding starts on that at $300, and the value of it is priceless. Another exciting thing you can do, and you can start doing this bidding on the silent auction, and you can continue it at the live auction, even if you're not at the event, electronically. And so that is to have golf with our very prestigious Congressman Hudson, Richard Hudson.
U.S. House of Representatives.
Yes, sir. And that would be a full day with him.
Right, the 9th Congressional District. And he is a fairly prominent guy up there in underneath the Capitol Dome. So, you'd learn a lot playing some golf with Richard.
You certainly would. So get three of your buddies and start bidding and have a day, a very, very special day, with Congressman Richmond Hudson. And by the way, he is an excellent golfer, I hear. I have never played with him, but I understand he has got quite a good handicap.
Well, you know, the politicians do have some time on their hands, so they can, you know, work on their game. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's what we learn. You're right.
I'm sticking a little bit of sarcasm. But, please proceed.
All right. The other thing that's been very nice is the Heritage Flag Company has donated to us a handmade American flag out of wood. Now, these are made out of oak whiskey wood barrels. And if you haven't seen one, they're really impressive, unbelievable. This has a value of $400, and your minimum bid starts at $75. Look how great it is of our local people actually contributing to this, our local businesses. Another business that's did a very nice contribution to us that you can bid on, and this is really special. Taylor Guitars, which is a great guitar, they're made out of California, have created a special guitar designed exclusively for appreciation of veterans. And it's called the Taylor GS Mini Guitar for Vets, special edition acoustic guitar. It has a value of over $1,099. It includes the case. It includes all the apparatuses with it. Plus, it includes lessons, $250 towards lessons.
Wow.
In addition. Yeah, this is a great event. Casino Guitars from Casino Guitars of Southern Pines obviously donated that, and we thank them very much. The next item, which is pretty exciting too, is from Deep River Sporting. We have a day of shooting clays.
Wow.
Which would be fun.
Yeah.
Get four of your buddies and basically start bidding for this and run up there to get that. Now,
right. Not guys named Clay, but actual clay targets.
Yeah, clay targets.
Yeah, right. Okay. Exciting.
You know, yes.
Yeah, it's fun.
I've done it. It's great fun. We also have, not to leave anything out, is the Sand Hills Bogies. And we've got two VIP season tickets for them. And that's a value of over $600. So basically, you would have the whole season. But what's fun about that is if you did get this, you also could donate them to friends or give them to friends.
And the Bogies, just so you know, is a baseball team, right?
Correct. Yeah. Correct. Absolutely. Yeah. And been around forever.
Yeah.
In that regard.
And I'm a big fan of the Bogies when it comes to playing golf. I'll take a bogey every time, but that's just me. Now, are there any other items that folks can bid on in advance?
Well, there's better than bidding. How about a raffle?
Yeah, how about it?
Okay, well, we've got lots of raffles here. Basically, what you can do is you can go ahead for $25, get a chance for a 5-day, 4-night cruise, and you pick the location.
Really?
Yes. And in addition to that, you can win some money. So for $25 per raffle or $5 for $100, you can be in the pool to win either $1,000 or $500. And finally, not having to be there, and maybe if you're not a golfer, but your dad is or your brother or somebody, you can get into the raffle for the new Callaway Elite Driver for $25. So there's lots and lots of ways to help. One of the other ways, because of what we're doing here, is to help our first responders.
Correct.
And we are looking and we need 32 good people to basically sponsor them at $250 each.
Right. So they can come out, play golf, have lunch, have a good time.
Yes.
And these guys, some of these first responders are quite proficient golfers. I've noticed that over the years. And they really enjoy it and they appreciate it deeply. Now, let's not leave out the golfers, by the way, Lou. If you want to play in the tournament on June 8th, I'm talking with Lou Bologna, who is coordinating the annual Republican Men's Club golf outing on June 8th at Pine Wild's Magnolia Course. If I want to play in the tournament, Lou, what do I need to do? I need to go to the website.
Go to the website. Pick whether you're a single. You can, if you're a single and you don't have a foursome, you can sign up and we'll match you up. Or if you only have two, if there's only two of you, you can do the same. And if you're a foursome, it's $250 per person. That includes your lunch. That includes the beer and soda on the course.
Well, they can't beat that.
Nope. I think that's a pretty good deal. And then also that gives you the opportunity to obviously to beat the pro, because which will be out on the field, and also the opportunity to win, not only to win the contest or the tournament, but clearly we have Cooper Ford was kind enough to sponsor a hole-in-one, and you would get a brand-new F-150 fully loaded.
That's a pickup truck, if I'm not mistaken.
It's a horse is what it really
America's is. America's best-selling pickup truck.
Yes, sir.
For many decades running.
And fully American-made. Couldn't be better for a patriotic event. So those are just some of the things that we're doing. And in addition, you will have out there the first tee will have one of their pros out there, and you'll get to play to beat the pro. And basically, you'll give a donation, and if you beat her, you get your money back plus. Is how it works.
It's a good deal all the way around. Everybody wins on that one. Now, we would be remiss if we did not also mention, Lou, the larger entity here, which is the Moore County Republican Men's Club, which meets once a month at Pinehurst Number 9.
Correct.
And features a keynote speaker and a delicious plated lunch. How do you you go to the website? You can join the men's club. You can if you know a member, you can ask them to take you along as a guest if you want to check it out. And membership is very valuable because it keeps you in the loop. It exposes you to interesting speakers, and you get to know like-minded fellow Republicans with a monthly luncheon get-together.
Yes, and it's actually more important now than ever because, needless to say, we have November coming up.
Yes.
And we want to beat all the odds. And by that I mean we have to keep the House and the Senate. Mm-hmm. No question about that. The Moore County Luncheon is a great, great event. And one of the reasons it is so nice is not only do you get to meet many local people there, but you also actually get to express your opinions and what your thoughts are.
Yeah.
And you get to talk to senators and congressmen, and you get to speak to many other very, very talented people in the political realm and see what they're doing, which is quite exciting.
And it's, you know, it's 60 to 90 minutes out of your day once a month, a very good use of your time. And with that, Lou, I will thank you for joining us today. June 8th, the Republican Men's Club golf outing. We hope to see you there.
Thank you so much, Steve.
And now our guest this morning is someone that I've been looking forward to introducing to our audience and talking to. He is Peter Schweizer. He is the author of a bombshell book entitled The Invisible Coup, How American Elites and Foreign Powers Use Immigration as a Weapon. Must reading, I would say, for anybody who wants to understand this phenomenon. Mr. Schweitzer, thank you for joining us.
Steve, it's great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
I want to remind everyone that that Peter is coming to Pinehurst and Moore County for the May 12 Lincoln Reagan Trump dinner hosted by the Moore County Republican Party, the party's major annual fundraiser of the year. And we look forward to hearing from you on May the 12th. If you're interested in attending, which you should be, I urge you to go to moregop.com, and there you will be able to purchase your tickets or learn how to purchase your tickets, and put that on your calendar, May the 12th, in the evening at the Country Club of North Carolina. Peter, the subject of illegal immigration has been brought to the fore roughly over the past decade since Donald Trump was first elected president in 2016. And it has certainly defined his presidency the second time around since he was reelected in 2024 by virtue of the fact that part of his legacy will be that the southern border is essentially shut down, closed, and no longer allowing untold millions to pass across it. But your book really broadens the discussion and the urgency of dealing with illegal immigration by identifying what we've been seeing over the decades as the most powerful political weapon ever aimed at the United States of America. That is a lofty statement, but can you expand on that and explain sort of how that motivated you to write this book?
Sure. Yeah. Look, we've had this national conversation about immigration, a very important one for several decades. And Donald Trump, I think, deserves enormous credit for sealing the border. But there's a lot to this story that goes beyond people coming across the border and, you know, suppressing wages and causing violent crime. The fact of the matter is that this constitutes an organized attack on the United States, which seems like very sort of shocking language to do to use. But the evidence is quite clear. We have foreign actors, the government of Mexico, the government of China, who themselves describe mass migration as a means of subverting and undermining American sovereignty. And you have some domestic progressives primarily who see this as a means to transform American society. Again, those are their words, not mine. So the bottom line is that we have to understand this is not a natural phenomenon. This is an organized effort. And what I lay out in the book is how that works. Before the book came out in January, I actually spent 55 minutes with the president in the Oval Office at his request to discuss the findings of the book. Secretary of State Marco Rubio was in the room, as was the Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent. And I laid out the case, and I think that it has been very helpful in really guiding the administration more recently in some of the policy initiatives that they're taking towards various countries.
The again, we're talking to Peter Schweitzer, the author of The Invisible Coup. One of the areas that you touch on very early on in the book is the role of Mexico in being part of this invisible coup. Now, we think about Mexico in terms of the southern border, and we think about it in terms of, whether or not it has been complicit in allowing illegal immigrants really from all over the world to pass undocumented into the United States. But the opening chapters of your book lay out a much broader and much more sinister, I would say, motivation in terms of Mexico, by virtue of the fact that it uses its consulate network within the United States to really expand its ambition, which is in the minds of many Mexican citizens to reclaim our territory. And when they say our, they mean the United States of America. You point out that there are in the United States at least 53 consulates, Mexican consulates. In contrast to that, other countries may have, even large countries like China, may have only six or seven of those. Can you explain to us how this consulate network operates and what its objectives are in terms of this invasion of U.S. territory?
Yeah, I mean, so when people think of Mexico, they tend to think of, you know, a country that's corrupt, the leadership is kind of hapless, that they you know, are embarrassed by mass migration, but they tolerate it. The fact of the matter is they speak about it very differently than we do. And in the book, I literally have dozens of quotes from senior Mexican officials. I'll read just one. This is from a Mexican Senator, Felix Salgado. He's with the ruling Morena Party. He sits on the National Defense Committee, which is the most powerful committee in Mexico. He said just a couple of years ago, quote, "Mexicans are in our territory, California, Nevada, Texas, Utah, New Mexico, Arizona, Kansas, Oklahoma, Colorado, and Wyoming. We're going to take back the territory that was stolen from us," end quote. And I could literally read dozens of quotes from Mexican presidents and other officials. And when you first hear that, you think, this is crazy. I mean, what are they talking about? But what you quickly realize when you look into it is that Mexico actually has a network in the United States. They have 53 consulates, as you mentioned. They also have this sort of bizarre system that I would say even the president wasn't aware of, whereby Mexico has senior government officials, Mexican officials, that live full time in the United States, and their job is to represent Mexicans in the United States before the Mexican Chamber of Deputies and Senate, which is a massive intrusion in our sovereignty. So that is how they view territory and Mexicans in the United States. And what do these consulates and what do these elected officials do? Well, again, in their own words, they are working at, quote, organizing the militancy inside the United States. They are organizing anti-ICE protests. They're meddling in American domestic politics. There was a meeting in a Mexican consulate in 2024, just months before the presidential election in the United States. They were meeting there. It was Mexican consular officials from across the United States, and it was Democratic Party activists. And the conversation, we have the transcripts I quoted in the book, the conversation included discussions on, we turned California from red to blue, we turned Arizona from red to blue, how are we going to turn other states from red to blue? This is not an appropriate function for foreign diplomats in the United States. So we need to recognize what's going on here with our neighbors to the south, how they view mass migration and how they view it as a political weapon to be deployed inside the United States against us.
And in that same chapter, you reference a woman named Karina Ruiz, and this really grabbed my attention. She lived in the United States and worked as a political activist, but was about to take up a position in the Mexican Senate as a member of the ruling Morena Party. She is the first member of their Senate to represent Mexicans living outside of Mexico. Now, that shocked me, and I guess it would a lot of other people. But this is part of their plan, having people like her in positions of influence.
Yes, that's exactly right. She is a sitting senator in the Mexican parliament. She lives full time in Arizona. There are also four Mexican consulates alone just in the state of Arizona. And she's introduced legislation in the Mexican parliament. She wants to designate California as a actual state of Mexico. You know, you have other officials that are serving in the Mexican parliament who live outside of Los Angeles. This gentleman went across the country last year. He said his job was to, quote, organize the militancy against Donald Trump. So let's be clear. These are foreign political senior officials that live inside the United States that are organizing political actions, interfering in our politics, and in some cases, encouraging I would argue, violent street protests against federal law enforcement. I don't know on what planet that is acceptable behavior by foreign officials. And that was one of the messages that I took to Washington, D.C., both the Capitol and the executive branch, when I visited there in January.
The other element of this, of your book, Peter, which is both fascinating and also very alarming, is the whole role of China in basically gaming our system to create what you describe as the Manchurian generation. Literally, China is coming in, allowing adults to give birth to their children, who then, by virtue of the birthright citizenship scam, later in life have all of the rights and privileges of a U.S. citizen. And they don't just do it randomly. Some of your sources point out that it is estimated that 100,000 of these children are coming in here per year, and that this has been going on for many years. And then when they turn 18 years old, what happens? They come back to the United States with voting rights, and they attend our universities, and on it goes. This is perhaps the biggest bombshell in this book, from my estimation. Can you talk about that a little more in depth?
Yeah, I mean, this is an industrial scale exploitation of birthright citizenship. In China, they call it birth tourism. And basically it is, you know, somebody sends their wife or their girlfriend to the United States for the express purpose, one purpose only, that is to give birth here. As soon as the child is born and can travel, they get the birth certificate, which gives them U.S. citizenship, and then they fly back to China, where that child will be raised in China. These are children of the elite. And the Chinese government itself actually encourages this behavior. This goes back to 2013 when the People's Daily, which was a Chinese Communist Party, their main newspaper, published a large article explaining how to do this and telling senior Chinese elites to do this. So there's a massive industry that, again, is sanctioned by the government that has developed there. There are more than 500 birth tourism companies that openly advertise in China. So what does this mean in terms of actual numbers? Well, we don't know based on U.S. data because we don't keep track of this number. Our federal government has no idea how many birth tourists come from China or from anywhere else in the world. But the Chinese government and experts have come up with some estimates, and they're eye-popping. The Chinese government estimates it's 50,000 a year. There are scholars like Professor Barbonis, who is in Australia, who travels to China all the time, certainly friendly with the Chinese. He believes it's 100,000 a year. And there are Chinese research firms that say in certain given years, it could be as high as 180,000 a year. So when you look at those numbers, those estimates, and you look at the fact that this has been going on for 13 to 15 years, you are looking anywhere at close to a million and a half, quote unquote, U.S. citizens that are being raised in China under the auspices of the CCP. And when they turn 18, as you point out, they're going to be able to vote in our elections. And it's very easy to establish residency in, you know, a lot of states right before an election. You don't actually have to live there. You can simply, sign a lease with 20 other people on an apartment somewhere, register to vote, and in a lot of states, they will send you a mail ballot wherever you live. So this is a massive existential threat, I believe, to our democracy. And that's the reason that this material, I was glad to see, was introduced by the Solicitor General when he argued the case against birthright citizenship before the U.S. Supreme Court last month.
And you point out in Chapter 5 of the book that based on what little data we have about Chinese to U.S. birth tourism, there is a tidal wave that could hit America, American society, beginning in 2030, which is, you know, just a few short years away, when the first baby wave reaches 18 years old. So the worst is yet to come, I guess you might say, with that projection.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this really began in earnest in 2013. There, it did happen before that, but it really exploded in 2030. So, yeah, you're starting to look at, you know, it started in 2013. 2030 is when they're going to be starting to turn 18 in large numbers. And I think this could have a massive effect on political elections. Let's remember, for example, the 2016 presidential election, Donald Trump won by 72,000 votes mm-hmm. in certain states. There's a lot of swing states. Elections now are basically settled in a handful of states. So the ability of somebody to game an election with 50 to 100,000 votes in a given state is enormous power, especially if it involves our foreign adversaries.
Sure. I mean, North Carolina is one of those states. And, Trump wins here by, 20,000 votes or something. But in other states, you know, like Georgia, he loses by 9,000 or 11,000. So it's a very slim margin in those swing states. And, you know, as if the Chinese are not bold enough to just come here and give birth, it's actually even worse than that, because there's this entire phenomenon which you refer to as a surrogate mothers being recruited to carry the children. This is really incredible. They carry the children of CCP officials. These officials then collect the children at birth and raise them back in China.
Yeah, this is something that when you first hear about it, you think this has got to be from like a science fiction novel. But in fact, it's not. And again, there's a large industry in China where Chinese elites, sometimes it's just a man, sometimes it's a man and his girlfriend or wife, will contact a American citizen, oftentimes in California, because there's no regulation of this in the state of California, and say, look, we want to impregnate you either with the sperm or the sperm and the eggs, and we want you to give birth. We'll pay you $60,000. The birth mother will carry the child to term. The child is born. The child is now a U.S. citizen, courtesy of birthright citizenship. They have the added benefit that the mother, the birth mother, is a U.S. citizen as well. But as soon as that baby is old enough to travel, they are taken back to China, where they will be raised in communist China. And some of the birth mothers report that they actually never even meet the parents. The parents don't even show up to pick up the child. Mm-hmm. So they worry about what actually might be happening to the child. Again, we don't have numbers. We don't track this in the United States. But a couple of, I think, pretty stunning data points. The Wall Street Journal about 2 months ago ran a story on a Chinese billionaire close to the Chinese Communist Party who, according to his subordinates, has more than 100 children born to surrogate mothers in the United States that he is raising in China right now. Just this one man. There's another case of a senior CCP official who lives part-time in California who was charged in 2025 with child negligence by California state officials. They found a compound where he had 26 children that were born by surrogacy. He had explained to a newspaper in China that his plan was for one of those children to run for president of the United States one day. So these are a couple of shocking anecdotes. We also report in the book that, according to our research, there are just in Southern California 107 Chinese-owned surrogacy companies that advertise these services back in China. So again, we don't know the scale of it, but these children who, again, are born here but have no connection to the United States whatsoever are U.S. citizens and will be able to vote, get government jobs, and have the rights and privileges the rest of us do.
And, you know, they don't even really try to hide what their long game is. I mean, you referenced this, the one Chinese businessman who owns more than $100 million in California real estate and is the owner of dozens of companies in California. Well, his surrogate kids, they live very well in a $4 million Southern California mansion and in plain daylight 15 children, ranging in ages from 2 months up to 13 years old. And they're living the life in Southern California. And I guess there's no accountability for that.
No, there is no accountability for that. And again, it's ironic, of course, that California, which regulates so many things, does not regulate surrogacy at all. And they are really ground zero for both the birth tourism with the pregnant Chinese women coming to the United States, but also for surrogacy as well. Really, you would hope that they would consider doing something at the state level to address this. But sadly, I think they view it as a political gain for themselves.
Folks, we're talking to Peter Schweitzer, who is the author of the instant bestseller, The Invisible Coup, How American Elites and Foreign Powers Use Immigration as a Weapon. Peter will be coming to Pinehurst on May the 12th to address the annual Lincoln-Reagan-Trump dinner hosted by the Moore County Republican Party. Visit the moregop.com website to learn how you can buy tickets and attend that event. Peter is the author of more than 20 nonfiction books, including a real groundbreaker from several years ago entitled Clinton Cash, which is a very self-explanatory title if there ever was one. And we are delighted that you're joining us today. Let's switch topics a little bit from the Chinese influence, and let's talk about the Catholic Church. And I was very interested in how the former Pope Francis was very much interested in using the Catholic Church in the United States of America to bring about some of his transformational objectives, to basically influence the American Catholic Church to focus on migration and social justice issues. Did he succeed at that?
I think he to a large extent did. And I think the new Pope, Pope Leo, is carrying on in his footsteps. I think the thing to understand, and this is, again, based on their writings, their words, is that people like Pope Francis or Pope Leo, church leaders that are progressives in their orientation, don't just view, immigration or sanctuary cities as a humanitarian gesture. They view it as a mechanism for social change in the host country. That would be us. So in other words, there is a agenda behind this. This is not, we feel bad for these people. We want to help them. They speak openly about the fact that this is transformational. It's going to change societies, and these societies need to be changed. And in their vision, Western societies in Europe and in the United States, for example, are too individualistic. They're too selfish. They're not collective in their thinking and in their mindset. So infusing those cultures with people from, let's say, more collectivist-oriented social backgrounds will be good. It will be good for all of us. Now, voters aren't choosing this, right? This is not something that people are necessarily choosing in the ballot box. It's something that's being carried out through mass migration. And that's what I think is so sinister and upsetting about this. It's not just humanitarian. They view migrants as a tool. They're in effect using them to advance the social cause that they so favor.
And you mentioned Pope Leo, and of course he is, as you say, willfully following in the ideological footsteps of Francis. In fact, I recently watched an interview with an expert on the Catholic Church, who basically argued that, in his estimation, it's not even clear that Pope Leo is Catholic, that he is actually more of a placeholder for the ideological overreaching objectives that were established very successfully by Pope Francis. That maybe is an exaggerated statement, but nonetheless, it makes the point.
Well, what we do know clearly, and of course, I don't consider myself an expert in theology. What we do know clearly is that Pope Leo absolutely comes from the strain of the Catholic Church that has embraced some forms of liberation theology. And liberation theology adopts a Marxist view that salvation is not just something that comes from, you know, the Lord Jesus Christ through faith. It's something that we actually do by changing our socioeconomic system. As I recount in the book, certainly Pope Francis had precious few criticisms of Fidel Castro and Cuban communism. In fact, when he visited there, he was very friendly. That would be in contrast to when he would visit the United States or other Western leaders. And you certainly, I think, see the same thing from Pope Leo. So my contention, and I think the chapter evidence is clear, is that the sanctuary movement is less about humanitarian concerns and more about advancing an ideological agenda. In fact, some of the founders of the movement in the 1980s, as I quote in the book, say exactly that, that the sanctuary is for those who want to perpetuate a radical social change in the United States. And their position was, we are not going to provide sanctuary for people who are not part of that agenda. So there was this selection process as to who they actually would support and protect and provide sanctuary for, and those who would not. And I think when you see the current posture of the Catholic Church, by the way, I would include other religious charities as well. There's Catholic charities. There's also Lutheran services, where the same rule applies, where they say explicitly that radical social change is their goal in supporting mass migration to the United States.
He foresees a world where borders become, as he says, privileged places of encounter, which is quite a way of putting it. But he apparently loathed the individualism and wealth of the West, and felt that mass migration was the only way to counter it. And I guess that, to some degree, is what we're seeing now, not just here in the United States, but certainly in Europe as well.
Absolutely. It really is a clash of civilizations. Samuel Huntington, who taught at Harvard for years, wrote a book in the 1990s called Clash of Civilizations. And he talked about how the world was divided between civilizations. You have Western civilization, Chinese civilization, you have Muslim civilizations. And he said we were going to have this global conflict. We were going to have different wars and flashpoints. My contention in the book is that we actually have a clash of civilizations occurring now within the borders of the United States, that it's being played out in that way. And you have progressives in the United States, I name them in the book, who have essentially sided with those other civilizations. And you have this bizarre alliance, the so-called red-green alliance, between radical socialists who say believe in trans rights and radical Muslims, the green part of the Red-Green Alliance, who certainly don't embrace any of those views. But it is a marriage of convenience that works with one common purpose, and that is the undermining of Western civilization.
The other topic that is touched upon in your book, The Invisible Coup, is the spread of a Muslim political activity across our country. And you particularly point to the political rise of Zoran Mamdani, the now mayor of New York City, as being emblematic of radical Islam's political network in the United States, and how he was basically enabled by parents with ties to many radical Middle Eastern entities. And here we have the mayor of New York, a figure that at one time in my life would have been unthinkable as even a viable candidate. What can we expect to learn about the long game for radical Islam in this country based on his time in office in New York City?
Well, I think one of the things that we have to understand and embed in our minds is that the notion of assimilating to American values, American society, is something that is now being actively resisted by foreign actors. The Mexican government, for example, we talked about earlier, they explicitly consider Mexicans that come to the United States, embrace American values, learn English, become proud Americans, are traitors. And they socially ostracize them. The same occurs within the Muslim community. Let me just read a couple of quotes. These are from senior officials with CARE, which is the Council on American-Islamic Relations. It's the top lobby for Islamic causes in the United States. This is what they say about the role of Muslims in the United States. The first gentleman is the head of Florida CARE, and this is from a speech in 2025. Have we asked ourselves this question? Why are we living in the United States? The only answer I believe is excusable and justifiable is if we are living here to shift this country's political and spiritual direction together. Or another quote, this is from a board member of the National Organization of CARE. He says, quote, ultimately, we Muslims can never be full citizens of this country because there is no way we can be fully committed to the institutions of this country. We can be citizens in the sense that we try to influence American policy. So we have to realize that we are dealing with something very different, what I call weaponized immigration, than the traditional immigration that we think of 100 years ago or even 50 years ago. The goal is not to assimilate. You have these very powerful forces that are saying, no, we are here in effect to transform the United States, not ourselves, to change and adapt to American culture. And with the Islamic community, this is a very, very aggressive posture. They say it in their own words, and I think we ought to show them enough concern and respect to actually believe what they're saying.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. People who are skeptical about, you know, U.S. border enforcement and the emphasis on stopping illegal immigration, you know, in our local newspaper, a gentleman submitted a letter to the editor in which he points out that in 2024, only 29 Americans were murdered by illegal immigrants, which is 0.0002% of the population. So in other words, he's saying, what's the big deal? Well, putting aside how callous that statement is, given that the families of those 29 Americans, their lives will never be the same. But if he reads your book, he'll understand that the peril of illegal immigration is far beyond any individual case of violence or murder or any kind of even petty crimes like robberies and things of that nature. This is a much more sweeping issue that we are only just now beginning to understand.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's why I said, look, we've been having a very important national conversation about immigration as it relates to jobs and wages and crime, but there's much more going on than that. And what I would say to people who have different policy positions on mass migration than I do is read the book. And don't take my word for it. The book is littered. There's, you know, 1,000 footnotes in this book. It is littered with original sources. So don't take my word for it that Mexico sees mass migration as a tool of reconquista. Read the more than dozen quotes from senior Mexican officials saying that in 2024, 2025. Don't take my word for it that Islamists have the goal of transforming the United States and that they see Mamdani. They saw Mamdani in 2021. They laid it out in 2021. I quote Islamist scholars saying, if we can get a candidate to run in New York, we have 10 to 12% of the population. We can win, and here's how we're going to do it. And that's exactly what they did. So I would say to people, don't bury your head in the sand. Confront the facts, confront the evidence, and confront the reality of what these people are telling us.
Peter, you mentioned your catalog of original sources. That is 47 pages of your book. I did the math. And that certainly suggests, to your point, the depth of research that went into this. And, you know, that for me brought to mind a gentleman who's one of the considered one of the greatest biographers of our time, Robert Caro, who has written prolifically about Lyndon Johnson, among other topics, probably more than anyone. And he wrote a book. He's still with us at the age of 90. He wrote a book several years ago entitled Working. And it simply described how he goes about the task of writing biographies, in-depth biographies about fascinating people. And he talked about the necessity when researching to make sure that you turn every page so as not to miss some very important detail. Can you tell us a little bit about how you dive into a complex subject like the mass migration coup and how you go about your work as an author?
Well, the research is my the phase that I like the most. I love the research. And if I could just be paid to research and not actually have to write anything, yeah. I would be very happy. Yeah. But no, my books, I produce a book roughly every 2 years. And I would say 18 months of that is the research. If you do a good enough job of researching the material, the book will write itself. I have a team of researchers here. I have a researcher who is, for example, fluent in Mandarin Chinese. So when we're dealing with original Chinese sources, we can get that material. But I go to original sources. When I first started writing books 30-something years ago, the challenge was always too little information. You'd have to go and look at the microfiche in the library. Today, the challenge is too much information. Yeah. So it's really sifting through the quantity. But we go to original sources. So the chapter on Mexico, you're going to see a lot of sources from Mexican government reports, the Mexican media, Mexican videos, the section on the Islamists or on the Chinese, you're going to find original Chinese sources. So you're looking for threads. You start pulling on those threads to see what unfolds. But to me, the most exciting part and the most important part of any nonfiction book is the research. We don't use any anonymous sources. Every source in this book, you should be able to go and find yourself if you want to. And that's why we provide the information the way that we do.
And I won't say that it's in your spare time, but another important part of your work day to day is the Government Accountability Institute, which you founded in 2012. Just real briefly, can you tell us about the objectives of the GAI?
Yeah, we investigate and research cronyism and corruption and abuse of power in Washington, D.C. We hit both sides. I have plenty of Republicans that don't like our research. You could ask Mitch McConnell about that. And you have plenty of Democrats who don't like our research. You could talk to Joe Biden about that. But the bottom line is, we want to provide accountability, and our moniker is to follow the money. So we have a staff of about 20 people. You can find out more about the research we do by just Googling Government Accountability Institute. And of course, I would also mention that we are a 501c3 nonprofit, and we operate with the donations of contributors. So we appreciate support that people could provide.
Peter, before we wrap this up, can you let us know how people can follow you on social media? Because I imagine you have some presence there as well.
Sure. You can find me on Twitter, X, at Peter Schweitzer. You can go to thedrilldown.com. I have a podcast called The Drill Down. You can subscribe to that on any podcast forums, or you can go to thedrilldown.com. And I also have a Facebook page where we update on research and, you know, some of my media appearances, et cetera. So we like interaction even on our webpage, our GAI webpage. If you know of corruption that you think should be exposed, we have a tip box and we do monitor that. So we always welcome tips and input from people.
Well, for now, we'll say so long, but we look forward to seeing you here in Pinehurst on May 12th at the annual Lincoln-Reagan-Trump dinner. Peter Schweitzer, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me, and I look forward to seeing everybody shortly.
Well, as always, we thank all of you for sharing Saturday mornings with us. For David Hensley, I'm Steve Woodward. We're back next Saturday exposing deception, corruption, and rhino imposters. Doing what we do best, taking aim.